I want to thank all of you for coming this afternoon to participate in a conversation about race and Cornell protests in the 1960s. My name is Ken Clark. I'm the director of Cornell United Religious Work, an office which played a pivotal role in the campus activism of the 1960s, in which home base Annabelle Taylor Hall was a central locus of the student activism of that era. The 1960s is a period which is a part of the memory of some of us, but is history for others of us, a history long ago and far away, far removed from 2014. Today's forum, which is part of a two-day conference called Vietnam, the War at Cornell, seeks to bridge the chasm between memory and history, between past and present. This bridge work is important because the past is always operative in some form in the present and implicates the future. We were reminded of this when then presidential candidate Barack Obama, in his historic speech on race in Philadelphia in 2008, quoted William Faulkner saying, "The past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it's never even passed." The current students sit in at Syracuse University and protest in September at Colgate University, both of which have focused on the resources and climate for historically underrepresented groups, correspond with the tensions leading to the takeover of Willard Straight Hall in April 69 and its aftermath. The past indeed is not dead and buried. It's not even past. A review of that past recalls the two powerful social movements sweeping through the United States in the 1960s and 70s. Opposition to the Vietnam War and the black freedom struggle symbolized by the civil rights / black power movements. America's college campuses, particularly Cornell, were central sites of this unrest. Today's forum brings together activists and professionals involved in the struggle of black students against racism at Cornell during that period. College campuses of the 1960s and 70s were important sites in the agitation which challenged de jure and de facto racism in America. There were three major approaches to black liberation in America in the 20th century: integration, nationalism, and the transformation efforts of Malcolm X in the last 11 months of his life, and Martin Luther King Jr. in the last 3 years of his life. All three of these approaches were manifest at Cornell in the late 1960s among the 250 black students on campus. This was a significant increase from the 10 black students enrolled in 1963. The challenge and struggle at Cornell to accommodate this dramatic demographic shift led to the takeover of Willard Straight Hall during that year's Parents' Weekend in April 1969. Our forum panelists were direct and supporting participants in this significant moment in the university's history. We are going to hear their stories and hear what has happened in their lives since 1969. We will begin first by introducing our speakers, and they will speak in the order in which I introduce them: Frank Dawson, Bruce Dances, Dave Connor, Susan Ruthberg, and Abby Ginsberg. They will each speak for about 10 minutes, and after the final speaker, Abby, has finished her remarks, we will then open the floor for a conversation between you and our former and current activists.
Good afternoon, everyone. I've got 5 minutes. I may speak a little quickly, but I'm gonna focus on how my involvement here at Cornell impacted the rest of my life. It's still strange for me to hear myself referred to as an activist. I certainly never considered myself to be an activist, but as a student, I was involved and I was engaged. I was a member, one of the students that was in Willard Straight Hall in 1969, young man, 18 years old. And that incident changed my life in a number of ways. The first thing it did was it gave me a career. I went into Willard Straight Hall as a government major. And during that time, found the government department to be one of the more conservative and reactionary departments on campus. And in Willard Straight Hall, once, and I'm not going to talk a lot about Willard Straight Hall, but once more guns were introduced into the building, I found the need to contact my mother to let her know that I was okay. We still had long distance access to long distance telephone calls. And when I called my mother to tell her that I was okay, she was crying. She said, "Oh, after all we worked, how hard we worked to get you there and all we sacrificed, you know, you could have stayed home and went to jail." You know, I grew up on a housing project on the Lower East Side of New York City, and that was an easy thing to do at that time. And but I told my mother, and my mother always believed what I told her. You know, I have sisters, but I was only boys, you know, and my mother really believed me. And I said, no, Ma, that's not what's happening. Everything is cool here. We're doing what's necessary. And she said, no. She said, that's not true. And I know because I heard it on the news. And I was that really caught my attention. I said, why my mother believes someone she does not know beyond her own son because she heard it on the news. I said, that's power. WVBR was located in Willard Straight Hall that we had taken over. First time I'd been in a radio station. I was impressed by the fact that when we first took over the building, we could announce our agenda. We've taken over just like in a coup d'etat, you know. And the transmitter was turned over to a remote transmitter, and we'd lost our voice. We could no longer tell our story in our own words. That's the other thing I was impressed by. After this Willard Straight Hall, my sophomore year, I joined WVBR Radio. I changed my major as well. I wanted to stay in the arts college, and communications was in the ag school, so I minored in communications, and I chose sociology as my major. How it's impacted the rest of my life, the time that I shared with the people who took over Willard Straight Hall and the African-American students at that time, they were the most intelligent and committed people I had ever been with in my life. It was a tremendous experience I will never, ever forget. And especially the fact that the commitment of students at that time was to a greater cause than ourselves. We were committed to taking what we had learned with our education here at Cornell and taking that back to our communities to make our community a better place. And the only way we could do that is if we changed what we were learning at Cornell. And that was part of the impetus in terms of the Willard Straight Hall takeover. Today, I'm now an administrator at Santa Monica College in California. I served for 16 years as a faculty member and as a department chair. I worked in the television industry for 20 years, naively thinking that I could change that industry. But I was committed that industry would not change me, and that's why I'm no longer in that industry. Became persona non grata, but I did found the CBS Black Employees Association based on my activism at Cornell, always wanting to organize and to do things. I started a writing program to bring more writers into Universal. And I also started worked, my first teaching gig was at USC when Bill Cosby started a program to bring more African-American writers into television. And that has been tremendously successful for 16 years, and it's changing the face of how television looks, that powerful tool that made my mother not believe me. Thank you.
My name is Bruce Dantzis. I grew up in a community of 40,000 people that was all white. But you might be able to tell from the remnants of my accent that's been diluted by 40 years of living in California that I grew up in the Bronx. I lived in Parkchester. Parkchester wasn't integrated until 1964. It was built in 1940 when the New York City Human Rights Commission sued. So I was aware that something was wrong with where I lived. My parents were members of the NAACP. They contributed to the Urban League, yet they found it no difficult. They had no difficulty living in an all-white community. I had a great deal of difficulty with that. When I was 15, I took part in the March on Washington and for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. And when I got back, I worked with Harlem Core. When I came to Cornell in the fall of 1965, my goal was to be active in the civil rights movement. But things were starting to change in the civil rights movement at that point. SNCC, the organization that I cared most about, the Students for Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was very closely affiliated with SDS, the organization I was in here at Cornell, kicked whites out of the organization in 1965. And in 1966, Stokely Carmichael announced they were going to pursue a policy of black power. And at first, it was very difficult for whites like me, who believed in trying to build an integrationist movement, we called it a multiracial movement in America, to accept that. You know, we wanted to fight against racism. But I attended an SDS National Council meeting where SNCC representatives came, and they explained, look, we still want you as our allies, but we need to organize in the black community, and what you need to do is fight racism in the white communities. And I accepted that. That made sense to me. Much of my activity at Cornell, it began to shape that. I still retained my integrationist dream. In those days, Cornell had a project that was run by CURW, the religion, and Paul Gibbons, who was a minister of the United Church of Christ, in East Harlem. We were affiliated with the East Harlem Tenants Council. In the summer of 66, I and around 20 other Cornell students spent the summer living in East Harlem, and I organized rent strikes. Other people were setting up daycare centers and things like that. But it seemed still possible to be working with a largely African-American and Puerto Rican population, you know, to bring about change. But at Cornell, it were difficult years in 1966 and 67. There was not a lot of communication between the more radical black students and the radical white students in SDS. SDS was never all white, but we had very few minority members. Things started to change here, though, when the African American Society was organized and when SDS began working on two programs beyond what we were doing around draft resistance and the war in Vietnam. One was we found by researching the Cornell Board of Trustees and the powers that be at the university, that Cornell was intricately tied in with the apartheid government of South Africa. In 1968, we discovered that the president of Cornell, a liberal man, James Perkins, was on the board of Chase Manhattan Bank, which at that point was the leading bank in a consortium that had lent money and provided a revolving line of credit to the South African regime. We found that 7 out of 9 members of the committee on the Board of Trustees were directors of corporations involved in South Africa. And we found out that Cornell held stock in 5 banks that were part of this consortium I talked about. And we felt this was wrong. And so did members of the African American Society, and we began a campaign around that. At the same time, we also began a campaign around housing in Ithaca, New York. We felt that Cornell was not doing enough to provide housing for students, and that students were then moving off campus and taking the housing that poor people had lived in. And where were they going to go? So these were a two-pronged campaign, and for the first time in 1968 and then later in 69, we had a real alliance between the white student left in SDS and the black student left in the African American Society. So at the time when the African American Society took over the Strait, we were primed and ready to support them. We were already talking, we were already allies, and at Cornell we formed SDS formed a perimeter around the Strait to try to put our bodies between the students in there and whatever was going to come get them out of there. It's one of the proudest moments I had at Cornell. And after the students came out of the Strait and the faculty reneged upon the decision that had been made to end that crisis, we were ready to take action in support of the black students. Unfortunately, I didn't stay around too much longer after that to keep up the struggle because I went to prison. I was a draft resister, and I spent the next 19 and a half months in federal prison in Ashland, Kentucky. I did try to keep working against racism at that time in prison, which is not a very good place for blacks and white people to get along usually. We formed an organization called The Family that was made up of the more political black and white inmates, and we stood together in solidarity in a place where there's not a lot of solidarity among inmates. We integrated the dining hall, which had been officially been integrated by Barrett Rustin and other COs in World War II, but had been de facto segregated here in the late 60s and 70s, and we integrated that just by our being friends with each other. When I got out of prison, my activism started to change. I became a journalist. and I was writing about entertainment. But one of the focuses of my life, I still care deeply about racism in America. I started writing about racism in Hollywood. I ended up writing a weekly column about DVDs. I became the entertainment editor at the Sacramento Bee in California. And one of my main focuses was how Hollywood distorts the images of black people, of Asian people, of Hispanic people, and why it does that. It became really one of the major focuses of my life. I know we have to wrap up quickly. One of the things I wanted to say now, when I first got involved in the civil rights movement, the struggle was about African American people getting the right to vote and then being denied that. And when I find myself now, one of the struggles that I'm trying to engage in is against the state legislatures that are trying to deny African American people and other people the right to vote. I think we've made much progress over the years, but in some places we're back where we started, and the struggle continues. Thank you.
Does this work? Am I close enough? How close to you? Oh. So this is one of those times when there's fewer degrees of separation all the time. I was ordained as a priest after busting out of Cornell back in 1964. I was ordained, sent to a conservative pastor because I had already slept through most of the seminary courses, and immediately got involved with Fight, which came in with Alinsky. So I discovered that Susan had had Jay Shulman take her whole class up there, and she knows what the acronym FIGHT stands for. Bruce, the bishop said, this guy needs to get back to Cornell, and sent me down here at the Cornell, I immediately got involved with what was going on the first summer I was here, which was the East Harlem Tennis Council CURW program. And I didn't know what you were doing, but I was trying to get into an apartment with cockroaches and a broomstick against the door off Lexington Avenue. And over the year that I went to CURW, we talked about why are white middle-class students mostly going down to East Harlem to help the tenants do vest pocket parts and organizing. So we invented, in the wake of the Kerner report about white institutional racism, a project called Project to Organize Whites to Eliminate Racism. Dan Berrigan and I and a nun and about 10 students all went to Yonkers and White Plains, slept in the church basement, and did PowerPoint presentations, attended select board meetings all about white institutional racism. Once we learned about that, it was easy for us to realize that we did the African Americans at Cornell or any other minority groups didn't really need predominantly white religious leaders trying to in any way get to the middle of the organizations that they were part of. So I was always impressed with Cornell's African American leaders because they seemed to know what they wanted. They were smart and they were savvy. And basically, I went to the SDS meetings and got involved in the anti-war movement, turned my draft card in, was hoping they would put me on trial, but they didn't want to since I'd been arguing against the war all over the country in different colleges. But what about race at Cornell meant to me was we were an institution and we had white institutional racism. And so I was always trying to figure out ways that we could make the institution be open to and able to accept the participation of all minority groups. Some of us went up and blocked bulldozers when the Indians were being invaded by Route 81 going to Syracuse. And I got to know the chief of the Cayuga tribe, because at our commune we had a young Indian woman that had been exploited and was a stripper. He decided to come down and visit her, so we got totally involved in what was going on at Wounded Knee and what was going on with Leonard Peltier and all of those times. In terms of the African-American political leaders at Cornell, I mostly was useful when DU guys tried to break into the Strait on the morning of the takeover. And I came down and immediately opened Annabelle Taylor Hall, and we set up an information center there. And Charlie Ackerman and I were asked by Cornell to go down on Parents' Weekend to the DU house and talk to them about the vigilante action. That was a very tough assignment, I must say. But we did it, and I hope after we were done that they understood more about what had been the backgrounds for that takeover, what the many efforts that had been done, the Ujamaa cross-burning, all of the different hopes for an African-American African-American study center. And I think that having people that could talk to the people who were institutionally involved about Black revolutionary activities and disobedience and civil disobedience and building occupations was somewhat helpful. On a personal note, I actually had played semi-pro basketball and used to go to relieve my tensions up at the gym. And there were always two big groups. There were the white, mostly basketball team guys that had the first court, and then there was a Black team that could have beaten anybody's ass. And I realized my summit bar would only be high if I could get one spot on the white team. I would never get a chance to shoot with the Black players. And I must confess that race at Cornell has been, to me, really wonderful, because I've been able to see the emergence of the Africana Studies Center and the things that have happened there. I was blown away when the big tragedy of Perkins's career has now turned into Eyes on the Prize, because I was invited to come back and march with Scorton and all the way from the Africana Studies Center to where the cross was burned at the women's dorm, to the first Africana Studies Center site next to Balch, to stand on the steps of the Strait and have our photographs all taken, and then to be fed various ethnic foods in the Strait as a celebration of the takeover of 1969. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be invited back. I'm delighted to be invited back to Cornell, to a place that I dropped out of in 1969 out of frustration that with all of our marching and our serious theorizing and our endless meetings, we weren't able to end this war. And my best friend at the time, Lisa Johnson, still one of my best friends to this day, we dropped out together and hitchhiked around Europe, where we understood that there was an international youth culture and that people were talking about the same things. And all over the world, it seemed, at least the parts of the world we visited, people were talking about questioning authority and how justice is a constant struggle and the personal is political. And all of those lessons I began to learn here. When I returned to college in 1970 to finish in a summer in the fall, I was swept up into the women's movement, which had been pretty dormant before I left. I remember sitting in endless SDS meetings with my hand raised, but not getting called on because I wasn't chummy enough with the guy who was running the meeting. So it was thrilling to be part of women's consciousness raising groups where we all talked about how, oh, the same thing happened to me once. And we provided each other with the kind of support that eventually led us to seek roles as professional women and actors in our society. When I came to Cornell, I was in the ILR school and they had an actual quota, 15 girls, 85 boys in the freshman class. It was a pretty hostile learning environment, and I was not used to that. I had come from a small town, but as you might be able to tell, I'm not shy, and I always got called on and spoke out against injustice. And I had come from a family where my father was particularly committed to the civil rights movement because his favorite nephew, my cousin Steve, was a freedom rider. And at the dinner table, we would hear stories of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King and my cousin Steve. And so I was determined when I got to college to make my father proud. He died before the year before I came. And I joined everything in sight so that I could somehow he'd be listening. And when I left Cornell after graduation, I ended up going to San Francisco, where I met up with a number of other dear old Cornell friends, including Abby Ginsberg. And we provided each other, we were part of a women's support group, and we went to law school in huge numbers. My class was 43% women, and the year before was something like 5%. When I graduated from law school, or during the course of my law school career, because of the experiences I had witnessed of the courage of the Black students taking over the building and forcing the university to change caused me to want to put my services as a lawyer in the service of poor black people who were charged with crimes. I had also had this amazing opportunity because of my allegiance to the Lawyers Guild, a progressive group of lawyers, to get sent to Chicago to help with the trial that was going on. Fred Hampton, how many of you know that name? Good, okay. So in 1969, Fred Hampton was murdered in his bed, and it turned out he was murdered by a conspiracy of the FBI and the Chicago police and the state's attorney's office. And the People's Law Office, PLO, in Chicago was waging a struggle to avenge the families. They filed a civil rights suit, and I was a mere foot soldier in this struggle. I was a law student waiting for bar results. But I, with other law students, uncovered a piece of paper that changed my life. We looked at the actual map. The FBI eventually turned over these documents, the map that the FBI informant, a paid guy, William O'Neill, had drawn to show the FBI and the police exactly where Fred slept, and a little X on his pillow. And Fred was murdered in his bed by the combined efforts of the FBI and the police. Seeing that my government would do such a thing, would actually conspire to murder someone that J. Edgar Hoover, who I view as an international war criminal, never punished on this earth, that he had caused, you know, his memo that he wrote about, we need to neutralize the new Messiah, and Fred Hampton was a charismatic speaker. In my later years, after being a lawyer for 15 years doing criminal defense, I became a law professor, and for 18 years I taught trial advocacy using Fred Hampton's words as my motto to my students. You can have as many degrees as a thermometer, but if you don't know how to talk to the people, you ain't shit. In Chicago, I got to meet Fred Hampton's mother, Iberia Hampton, and that was one of the most extraordinary moments of my life. Aside from telling me that I was too skinny and she needed to fatten me up, she talked about what her son meant to her and what it meant to her that she was able to walk into a federal courtroom and sue the government for the wrongful death of her son. After that experience, when I graduated from law school, I worked at a small community defender office that was funded by the Model Cities Program, part of Johnson's Great Society, that never got to be fully developed because of the money spent on the war instead of on anti-poverty. But in that office, I made friends with young women my own age, but they had all become pregnant before they were 18 because of the circumstances of their birth and their being raised in an atmosphere of extreme poverty. So those young women helped me steer a clear path to becoming a people's lawyer, taught me things like, if you want these people to treat you like a lawyer, you better stop dressing like a field hand. And I gave up my overalls. From that experience, I worked as a public defender, and I began to do clinical law teaching. And then in 1986, I had the opportunity to work on another Panther-related case. A young lawyer named Steve Bingham was accused of smuggling a gun to George Jackson at San Quentin Prison in 1971, when I was still an undergraduate. And as my mother said, that gave me an alibi. And when Steve then went underground for 15 years, when he came back, by that time I had been a lawyer with 10 years experience, and I got a chance to be co-counsel on Steve's trial. And that was an extraordinary moment in my life too, to be able to sift through the history of our time that we had lived through, to present it as part of the cultural defense we fashioned for Steve, to show that he was a nonviolent social justice guy as a product of his times. He had been someone who had gone south to register voters and worked for the farm workers. He had a peaceful social justice aimed life and was accused of this heinous crime of bringing a gun to George Jackson, which led to the deaths of six people at San Quentin in 1971. Steve was acquitted after a year-long trial, and I went back to my life as a public defender, and then eventually became a law professor. In my years of being a law professor, which just ended, I've just retired, I tried to teach my students how to understand their own privilege and how to rise above it, work around it, go under it, find some way to become allies with those who our society still treats in a very unjust way. And so I'm very proud of my experiences here at Cornell and how they shaped the rest of my life. Thank you.
Given what you've heard from everybody else, I think I'm going to start at the end and move backwards. So this film, Agents of Change, which is being co-produced by Frank Dawson and yours truly, Abby Ginsberg, is our attempt to do a documentary that half of which will be about the takeover of the Strait at Cornell. And so you might say, well, it makes sense that two graduates of Cornell who were involved, one on the inside, one on the outside, would want to tell this story. It may make sense. What it doesn't tell you is that for 5 years we've been struggling to get this film made, and if you come at 7:30 to the next panel that we're going to be on, you get to see the Cornell segment. So I want to encourage, it's at Urus Auditorium in, I don't know, the bottom of Urus, is that where it is? Okay. So that's where it is, and I really want to do a pitch to have you come, because part of what I want to say about this is, Frank talked about the impact of the community of people within the building. I could talk about the community of people outside the building and how that really changed our lives. But I think the pictures add a lot to this story, and the testimony, we have two of the people who've been interviewed for the film here, at least two. And I just want to really encourage you to come out and see it, because I think we're breathing life into this period by making a movie about it. Okay, so, and why would I want to spend, you know, my life as a documentary filmmaker telling this story? The reason has really been reflected in everything that everybody here has said. These were seminal years for us. And yes, I came from Manhattan and I'd gone to a public school, and I went to a minority school, whatever. Whites were the minority in that school. And when I got to Cornell, I'd never seen so many white people. I mean, I grew up in Manhattan. I grew up riding the subways of New York. I'm like, where am I? And how am I going to survive this place? So I came to it from a very different, you know, background than the average person. And so for me, you know, figuring out how to make this place hospitable to people of a different ethnic backgrounds was like critical, because I literally felt uncomfortable in an all-white environment. And much of my life has been spent often being one of the few white people in other contexts. So I want to share another thing about, you know, someone said, you know, the past is not even past. 3 weeks ago, I was at Harvard, where black activists from around the country, blacktivists, it was a blacktivism conference, came together. It all had gotten organized before Ferguson happened, but everybody was really impacted by what had happened at Ferguson. And here were students from 300 different campuses, maybe 150 different campuses, two from each, getting together to figure out what to do about the issues of racism and inclusion on their campuses right now in 2014. And I was not only one of the only white people, I was by far the oldest white person in the room, but I was there to film a spoken word presentation called I Too Am Harvard, which is fabulous and will one day be available to all of you, one day soon. We're editing it to put it up on the web. And what was moving about that is that so many of the issues that students in 1969 and 1968 were fighting for are still relevant. I mean, whoever thinks we are living in a post-racial society is wrong. And so there's a lot of work that still needs to be done and a lot of support of these students that still needs to happen. And that's kind of like what my life has been about. I was a lawyer for 10 years. I'm glad I got, you know, I didn't try to compete with Susan Rutberg because I wouldn't have made it. I went to a law school, actually, that only had 10% women. And you know, I felt that I was sort of on the cutting edge of women getting into the profession. And after 10 years of it, I thought, I've got to find something else to do with my life. And that led me to become a documentary filmmaker, where race has infused all the stories that I've told. And so my whole life has really been about trying to tell stories about, you know, both individuals, the historical backgrounds out of which they come, with themes of race and America being pivotal to the kinds of challenges that these folks faced in their lives. And so at the last film that I just finished, which will be shown at Cornell Law School at 5:30 on Wednesday, if you have time for another movie, is about a South African who was an anti-apartheid activist. His name was Albie Sachs. He was on this campus a year ago. Some of you may have heard of him. Anyway, Albie was blown up. Albie was a white man who was a lawyer who acted in defense of anti-apartheid activists in South Africa. And he was blown up and lost his arm as a result of a car bomb attempt. The film is called Soft Vengeance, and Albie Sachs in the New South Africa. And what the film is about is trying to find ways of building a new society from the ashes of apartheid. That was very compelling and interesting to me as somebody who's very troubled by what's going on in the rest of the world today, where people who are in opposition to each other basically, you know, shoot each other depending on who's in power. And the fact that South Africa was able to find a way through in spite of all the violence and all the, you know, historical oppression that had happened, but they found a way to begin to build a new society, I felt like there were really lessons for all of us in that. So for me, my life has been about trying to find the positivity, as Albie calls it, as we challenge ourselves and as we challenge those around us to try to figure out how we're going to respond to inequity, to racism, you know, and to the things that we need to change. We just came from a class where people said, you know, what are we supposed to do when the vision of the revolution is no longer on the horizon? We can't see it. And, you know, I guess what I would say is that what I learned at Cornell and what has motivated me for the rest of my life is that if you are working hard to change the inequities around you, be they racial, economic, or whatever, that in the long run, what you're doing is trying in the interstices of your own life to try to create the society that you hope will ultimately be reflected in the larger world around you. And, you know, 45 years later, we're still struggling, and we're going to struggle to the end of our days, and we know we have to encourage the next generation to do the same thing. But I want to say a big thank you to Cornell for having sort of set me on the right path and having given me a life's work that I can look back and be proud of. And so I'm really grateful to be here, and I'm really grateful to have kind of cut my teeth right here. So thank you.
And I also want to say what I intended to say at the beginning. I wanted to give thanks to Professor Isaac Kramnik, Professor. Professor Gerald Aking, Director of Africana Studies and Research Center, Arts and Sciences in the Government Department, for making this conference as well as this forum in particular possible. I want to begin our question and answer session, which we will extend to all of you to participate in, with a question to our panelists, and that is a question about that I would like to ask them to respond to tell us about the on-the-ground relationship between the Afro-American Society and the Students for Democratic Society, or SDS-AAS. Where did you converge? Where did you diverge in that relationship?
Well, I reflected a little bit about that, that there was a period when we weren't doing a lot of talking. I remember feeling sort of bereft of the lack of black friends. When I came to Cornell, there were black people in my classes. I was on the track team. But then in the movement was mostly white, and it was discouraging. At that point, I think when we coalesced around certain issues around South Africa, we had a clear, the opposition to racism and seeing Cornell's complicity with racism in South Africa was something we all could relate to and see that we were affected by it. Our tuition was going for that. Looking at housing in the city and the impact that had on Ithaca's African-American population, that affected all of us. And I think we began talking again around that time. So when the straight takeover took place, we were already in communication and already in a point where we were ready to act in concert with the students. When it appeared that the university was going to keep its insane prosecution for petty actions, you know, even after Black Study Center had been agreed upon, where they were going to still bring people up against the Judiciary Board, we thought that was ridiculous. We were prepared to seize other buildings in support of the Black students. We were prepared to put, just as they had put their lives on the line to do that, we felt it was important for us to take a stand, you know, and be ready to put our bodies in front of police or National Guard if they were going to try to get the students out of there. It was a strong alliance, and we made friendships again that maybe hadn't existed for several years before that.
I'd like to mirror something that Irene Smalls, said a little bit earlier in terms of acknowledging that there were certainly points of intersection. But I'm also going to borrow from a documentary that I saw recently called Mr. Dynamite about James Brown, where James Brown on the Mike Douglas show gave David Susskind a history lesson. A very, very important one.
Could you tell us who David Susskind was?
They know who James Brown was?
Yeah. I mean, we all know up here, but.
Oh, I'm sorry. These a very well-noted television talk show host and journalist and there. And I was so proud of James Brown at that moment. David Susskind was talking about how on the campuses, Black students are segregating themselves. They sit at the dining room tables by themselves. You know, they don't interact with the white students. This is wrong. This is moving backwards. And James Brown said, No, wait. I really have to interrupt you there because I think you're wrong on this point. And James said, why can't we have the time to learn about ourselves? We haven't had an opportunity to know ourselves. You know, it's not that we're segregating ourselves from you, but we need the time to learn about ourselves. I thought that was profound. You know, and David really didn't get it.
No.
You know? First of all, he was paternalistic. He kept referring to James Brown as Mike Douglas, who's even called James Brown. David Susskind kept saying, Jimmy. You know, I thought James Brown was going to knock him out. But it was such an important point. As it went a little bit further, David Susskind says, no, I'm not wrong about this. It's like, Jimmy, you should be able to, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the idea was you should want to be able to, at some point, know that you can be as good as us. And James jumped out of his chair and he said, man, I know I'm as good as you. Very, very important. So, did we have issues as far as the war is concerned? Of course we did. But in terms of priorities, in terms of what we needed to do, given the opportunity we had been given, our most important thing was addressing the needs in our own community.
You took my stuff, Frank. Whenever it was Malcolm and Martin, I was always on the Malcolm side, you know? And I don't know if you've ever seen the TV play where Martin Luther King and Malcolm have a discussion and argument. And I realized, because I used to, you know, besides wanting to play basketball, I wanted to have Black friends at campus and show friendship. And it was hard to crack not only in the basketball game, it was hard to get on the table at the lunch. And I thought it over and I said, they're building an incredibly strong community with each other. What the frick am I worried about? To make me feel like I've done something for civil rights because I was nice at the table? So I really think that is an incredibly important thing. And I think that most of us, after we realized how glad we were, there were so many smart, activist, strong-thinking men and women, African-American, that were here, and were bonding and connecting with each other, and were protesting with their own agenda, they didn't need us to help articulate it or us to be part of it in order for it to feel authentic and be authentic and be exemplary for the rest of us.
I really ditto that. You know, there's a line in Dear White People where she says, "Dear white people, having two friends is now what it takes to not be considered a racist." Or it's not what it takes. Anyway, what I would say is I think that for me, recognizing that that was the period that we were in, it was really a moment. I mean, we were in a period where people weren't noticing you and it didn't matter. I mean, you had to make it not matter. You were going to walk around feeling bad all the time. And I think what Dave Conner just articulated is what progressive white people came to teach themselves, you know, without it ever being articulated, really. It was like each of us had to come to that moment on our own and realize, A, it's not personal. You're not being personally rejected. Some other larger cultural force is taking place right here, and so you might as well try to figure out what it is and be supportive of it.
And there was a strong impetus to teach us to organize in the white community. There was a change in the air when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I remember going around apologizing to all the black students on campus that I knew, as if somehow it was my fault because I was white. And I think that it was, because we had been walking around wearing this mantle of privilege that was invisible to us, but it protected us. You know, this may be irrelevant, but bear with me one sec. There was an article in today's Cornell Daily Sun that I read about Adderall use on campus. Don't raise your hands if you've used Adderall. But there was a quote from one young man, presumably a white man, at the end saying, "Oh, I'm not worried about it. Nobody can tell if I'm using Adderall and if I carry it with me or it's in my car or my backpack. Nobody, the cops are not going to stop me. I'm going to be fine. This is not a problem." And I thought to myself, this has to be a white student. Right. And it's not the same. It's still not the same. And the only way we're going to move past that is if we, who wear that mantle of privilege, find ways to pierce it and share that with others.
Thank you all for your responses. And we are now going to open up the floor to you to have a conversation with our panelists. Yes.
Thank you. I'm Russell Whitford. I'm in the History Department here. Thank you so much for your presentations, and I honor your contributions to our ongoing struggles. I guess what I wanted to ask is part of the problem with recounting these stories is that young people, young progressives and radicals, tend to see the 60s as a sort of hegemonic, paradigmatic, you know, expression of protest. And so to the extent that they fall short of those images, they don't, you know, feel like they're genuinely participating in protest. Having said that, you know, the system has adjusted in profound ways since that time. You know, mass incarceration, right? Mass imprisonment, the expansion of neoliberalism, and even the ways in which the system has, as was alluded to, sort of co-opted and appropriated some of the images and messages of that time. So I was wondering if you'd reflect a little bit on some of the perhaps shortcomings of your own strategies and ideologies, given how the system has adjusted and transformed since then. Perhaps, what would be your advice to young people, young radicals today, in terms of what to do differently than what you
did? I'll just start with a brief thing. I think we alienated a lot of people with our rhetoric. And I think I remember haranguing my family around the Thanksgiving table about the injustice of the war and how could we be eating turkey when there are people starving in Biafra. That was just one Thanksgiving. So I think it's... I think it's important to understand that, to pay attention to where other people are coming from and try to meet them where they are, instead of assuming that you have a universal purchase on correctness. But I don't know how much of that has to do with youth.
That's youth.
Yeah.
Other than the climate change demonstration this past September, the most exciting demonstration I've taken part in the last 5 years was in Sacramento, where I live in California, where around 10,000 students from the University of California system, the Cal State system, and the community colleges came together. It was the most diverse crowd I've ever seen in my life. There were organized white students, Black students, Hispanics, Asians. It was an incredible coalition. And all these people came from different organizations, but they were fighting against the budget cuts in the California education system. And I thought, to me, this can be a model, that we can have different organizations that pursue our different agendas, but there are a lot of areas of common interest and common needs and social progress where we can come together, and we need to find those means where these organizations can coalesce around issues, candidates, whatever. But I think, to me, that was a model. And I was very inspired by the young people there, that they had no problem working together and working apart. And it seemed a very natural development. And it was not a question of divided identities and identity politics. It was people coming together for common needs and common goals.
I think the biggest failure is the incredibly scandalous incarceration of an entire three generations of African Americans in our prison systems under squalid conditions with incredible lockdowns, and the fact of the helplessness of in a democracy of a predominantly sympathetic white population to stop it, to protest it, to change it, to create more and more legal aid help, to lock ourselves into the prisons ourselves and refuse to leave. It seems like there has to be an ability on the incarcerators to actually free those incarcerated.
Can I just say something about that? I mean, California has now just enacted two really important propositions. We've just reduced sentences from felonies to misdemeanors for many drug offenses, and we also reduced from felonies to misdemeanors, what was the one last year, Prop 36?
Third strikes.
We got rid of it
to misdemeanors, but we eliminated
the third strike. So we've done two statewide efforts to sort of address some of this, which, you know, normally I'm not somebody who kind of thinks that that's a very useful way to go. It's been extremely useful on this issue. So I think, you know, 45 years ago, I probably would have been really opposed to such an initiative process. And today, I think it can be really positive. And so, sort of echoing what Dave is saying, there is going to be a new movement starting on this because the Open Society Institute just gave $50 million to the ACLU to try to come up with new alternatives to incarceration. So I would say if this is an issue that moves you, and it should be one, there's going to be work for all of us to do on this. So.
Yeah, I would just add to that this is such a different time in terms of visibility is concerned. One of the issues California is going to face, and it's been in the newspapers, is with the change in this law, the jails are going to be forced to allow so many Black and brown prisoners out of jail. And for people to say, you know, because the numbers are staggering in terms of the number of Black and Hispanic men that are incarcerated on drug crimes that have been, you know, been felonies that are going to be reduced. There's going to be so many people released. That's going to be very visible. And so I think visibility is an issue today. The 60s was such an extreme time. I mean, really, really a different time. And it's hard to apply that time to today. I know, as you know, from a visual standpoint, I first wanted to do this project as a theatrical film, and I wrote a script about it, and I was watching projects on the 60s, and characters were really caricatures. Mm-hmm. You know, during that period, when you define them in today's terms, I mean, the long hair, the dress, it's very, very difficult to understand the issues when it was such an extreme time. It's hard for people today to relate to that, you know, because of the visuals. I wish I had a better answer for you. But because a lot of the things that were accomplished during the 60s were not really sustainable, you know, and that's something I don't think we understood enough at that time, you know, that there has to be constant work done And I'm disappointed myself in that. And I think we've also done a poor job as far as building a bridge back to young people as far as information and understanding of that time is concerned.
Other questions, please.
You were all very instrumental in the creation of the Africana Studies Center now. And I wonder how it felt to you, what your thoughts have been recently when the administration dismantled a lot of what had been created and changed the status of the Africana Studies Center.
I don't know if we're the right people to address that.
But maybe there's others in the audience who could speak to that.
Yes. There are probably people who could better, you know, as an alumnus, I was somewhat aware of what was happening, and it goes back to the whole idea of sustainability. We're talking about for 40 years, the Africana Studies and Research Center had maintained certainly not complete autonomy, but certainly more control. More control. And for 40 years, it was an issue. And the assaults on that program occurred over the last 40 years. And I think we got down to the point where, once again, as far as sustainability, a lot of the pressure that was waged to maintain that came from the outside. And so I don't know if the mission has necessarily changed. I think people's thinking in terms of what was best for the center might have changed as far as a perspective on it, and you certainly might be able to address that better than I am.
Yeah. I might say something. Yeah, I'll do that. I'm Gerard Atching, the current director of Africana, and a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, what had occurred sort of physically and also in terms of administration is that Africana was moved from being under the provost to being part of the College of Arts and Science. So that was the move that was made. And of course, the move was a difficult one. It was difficult precisely because on occasions there was a lack of consultation in that move. And I think so that reverberates very strongly because it may mean and it symbolizes the same old in terms of the treatment of certain people. You know? So that became an issue, but I can assure you that in terms of a mission, which is to, for us, what is very important is to always make sure that we understand and speak about the relationship between activism and scholarship. You know? It's not an either or situation. No, it's one in which both things happen for the better of both, we think, and that is our mission. At the same time, it also means that Africana will always have in view its eminent history, no, the way that it began, the efforts of people who are here today and others, so that would not be forgotten. So, yes, there is also the question of, you know, having the other generations see the struggle that went into this and how it continues afterwards, you know, but that is the challenge for us all. So, thanks.
Her and then Irene.
I just wanted to expand on what's been said here. I think there's a wonderful word in Spanish.
Could you stand up?
Sure. There's a great word in Spanish, protagonismo, which means wanting to be at the center of everything. And just what Frank Dawson was saying about how people dressed and how that can take attention away from what you're doing, I think that was one of the failures of our generation. Everyone had to be a star. And these issues should not be star issues. They can be fought on individual levels as well as group levels. And I think one of the things we should take away is that it's the issue that matters, not a particular person on stage rousing everybody. It's the issue. And we can work on that in any number of ways.
Irene.
Hi. In terms of the issue of Africana, my name is Irene Sullivan. I'm the founder of the Canal Black Alumni Association.
Association, and one of the things that really motivated me to start the Cornell Black Alumni Association was I recognized that once I graduated, once the students from the 67, 68, the classes of 70, 71, 72 graduated, that there was a shift. There was a shift in the kinds of students that were African American students who were recruited. There was a shift in the focus in terms of how they were treated, and I was interested in sustainability. So the idea was to create an alumni association that would be able to put pressure on the university in terms of fundraising, put pressure on the university in terms of involvement, and trying to maintain the progress that we had made in terms of Africana, in terms of Warri House, in terms of all those other kinds of things, and in terms of looking back. But I think that should have been a clearly articulated goal. And it wasn't. My idea was we need to sustain this. And the only way we can sustain it, the university responds really well to groups that give money. The university responds really well. I mean, looking at from a pragmatic point of view, and I said the African American students do not have that voice, so let's form one. And the idea is that we'll be able to network, maintain, and also to be a pressure group to maintain the Africana Center, and I think that's something that got lost in the translation. So I hear Frank and understand that we weren't thinking as comprehensively as we should have or as long-term as we should have, but I was aware that once I left, you know, that things were gonna, you know, you had a really radical group, you really did, and the students that were coming behind us were not as radical, were not as passionate, we were willing to die, I mean, literally. People walked in the street and knew, we might die, okay, let's go. You know, and we were willing to do that, we were willing to do whatever it took, and the students that were coming behind us were not as passionate, were not as committed. So I felt that there was a way to kind of keep that fervor of those heart and soul folks, those gut bucket folks, you know, let's roll, what you got? You know, in terms of connecting them continuously to the university through the Alumni Association. And I think the Alumni Association does wonderful things, so on and so forth, but it hasn't been sort of the lobbying group that I had envisioned in terms of saying to, you know, Renee and a couple of people, listen, we got a group here, girl. You know, we're forming a Cornell Black Alumni Association, and these are the kinds of things that we need to do. So I want to share that I think that Africana was a piece that we could have been more decisive with. And, you know, again, but we learned, you know, the past is not even in the past. So we can move on and recognize where we are and the kinds of things that we need to do to create momentum to hopefully bring things back to a more of an equitable level.
Thank you. Dr. James Turner, who is the founding director of African Science and Research Center. You had a comment?
Yeah, I wanted to raise the question about this issue of lens and race. But the question raised about what happened recently means that I cannot ignore that issue in good conscience. What happened with the provost making a unilateral autocratic decision to transfer the Africana Center from 40 years of existence in a particular kind of organizational institutional arrangement was not benign. We were called to a meeting without any prior information about what the substance of the meeting was to be. We were not told what any of the agenda was going to be. And when we came to the meeting, it wasn't a meeting. It was a dictum that was offered. And when the faculty asked, can we discuss it? The answer was no. And we learned later why that was so. Because there had been a group of people in various parts of the university, the dean of the faculty, others, who had been informed that this was going to go down. and that their support, or at least their silence, would be considered favorable to the decision. Also, an email was prepared, and shortly after walking out of the room with talking to our graduate students, the email was released to alumni around the country and wherever they were known. A press release was offered. All this was orchestrated and planned without any discussion with the faculty and the students. I had never seen an occasion like that in the 40 plus years that I've been on faculty. But it also harkened back to the past in which we were struggling from. Here was white power able to sit in the face and say to black people, men and women at the table, your voice doesn't count. And I'm not even going to pretend that I would listen to it. Understand the history in which you're talking about, what that meant for us, what the consequence was, and what the humiliation was. Should we make a move on this to salvage our own sense of dignity, or do we stand and accept it? The internal voting rights, basic to democratic participation, were abrogated. So it is not an easy subject, and it has left a sense of tension that is still palpable. Now let me say something about what was on my mind initially. When one observes the narrative about the 60s and race at Cornell, much of the argument that I've heard over and over centered on black people and the gun, and it being a prospect for violence. When in matter of fact, the actual violence, the concrete expression of violence, was the firebombing of that building on Wade Avenue that housed the Africana Center. And that is almost never fully discussed in the narrative of that period. Thank you.
Comments from our panelists?
I have just a really sort of cockamamie idea. But when I look at the wisdom and the history and the knowledge and the thinking and the organizing that have gone into this 40 years, I'm thinking, is it possible to do what white institutions do, which is to not wait to see whether it'll be under one wing of Cornell or another wing of Cornell, but in conjunction with the Africana Studies Center, start an Africana Studies think tank that's separate from the Cornell, that brings together all the wisdom of a Dr. Turner, all the wisdom of the people that have been there before, and studies the issues that are still salient today, and uses the think tank to affect policy at international and national levels. It's just a wild idea, but I'd like it to be thought about.
Thank you, David. Other questions? Yes.
Can you speak about how receptive or supportive the Cornell faculty members or professors were to some of your efforts during your time on campus? Did you find yourself speaking out against what they're teaching in class, the books that they wanted you to read, and kind of checking what they were teaching the other students?
You want to start, or I'll get you?
Certainly there were individual faculty members that were cooperative and knowledgeable and understanding and were an asset. I'll take a quote from one of the things Dr. Turner says in our documentary. One of the things that was different during that time is that the administration tended to be more progressive than the faculty members were, paraphrasing, that it was the administration that was more progressive than the faculty in general terms speaking. And as I mentioned in an earlier presentation that I made, in the government department, I started off as a government major, and I found that that was more, one of the more conservative areas in the college during that time. And that was very difficult, and I found it much easier in terms of navigating Cornell once I changed my major. I think there were other departments in which the economics department, for example, there was a professor there in terms of some things that were said about the lack of contributions of black people as far as economics or any of the other areas are concerned. So there were some issues as far as faculty were concerned, as far as being supportive. But as I said, there are always exceptions to the rule.
I mean, I guess what I would say, you know, the faculty that was sort of most conservative and went crazy after the takeover of the Strait, and when the faculty reversed itself to sort of dismiss all the charges against the students who had taken actions, there were a number of high-profile government professors, particularly, who left the university. At the same time, there were a number of fabulous professors who were here and who really had both the back of the students and had the same kind of worldview. And many of us developed our worldviews based on, you know, having had those faculty members teach us. I mean, the Doug Dowds of the world need to be remembered. I mean, Doug was a real radical, and many of us took classes with him, and it just made a huge difference to feel like there were a few adults who saw the world the same way you did as an 18 or a 19-year-old. And as I say, often our worldviews were changed as a result of having a few adults, you know, help us see the world the way they saw it. So the faculty was quite divided, and, you know, many of us don't know exactly what happened when the faculty voted to reverse itself and actually drop the charges against the students. But we know that there were important faculty members that played a role in trying to have, quote, the university come to its senses. And so I think, as on any campus, just like the students were somewhat divided, the faculty was certainly divided. And in spite of the fact that the administration was more probably liberal than the faculty, there were really key members on that faculty who helped shape the worldviews that many of us were forming at the time that led us to become radicals. So it was a mixed bag.
There were a lot of reasons for African-American students to be upset with the Cornell faculty. The case that Frank is referring to, there was a visiting professor, McPhailen, in the economics department, who was an out-and-out racist. And the students complained, tried to bring up opposition to what he was saying in class, and he would dismiss it. They raised they brought it to the attentions of the department chairman, then the deans, then the vice president, and they got nowhere. And eventually they had to take over of the economics department office to protest that. This happened just months before the Strait takeover. It was part of the process there. The faculty was always divided. It was, I think the cause of the students was heard immeasurably by the coverage in the New York Times. There was we all remember the name Homer Bigger, to those of us who was around that, a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. But in his reports on the Strait takeover, he wrote about as if armed black students have just taken over the Strait, and they're holding the university hostage until they get their demands. Rather than the students nonviolently went into the Strait, took it over, repulsed a group of frat boys who came in and tried to attack them, who promised to take vigilante action against them, were going to arm themselves, and it was only at that point when the students armed themselves. This wasn't reported in the newspaper of record, but that's what was happening on campus. And that, unfortunately, turned the tide of faculty members. Now, let me say this, and there are some faculty members. Jim Matlick is here, who was part of a group called Concerned Faculty, who stood solidly behind the students in the Strait, the students who were protesting in support of them, and were ready to put their bodies between the National Guard and the police if they ever came through there. And they have my internal admiration for standing up for the students and all that at a time when a majority of the faculty at first was unwilling to do that, was unwilling to do what they found being pushed around by black students. So, I mean, there were many honorable people here at that time who took strong and courageous stands, and many of whom never got tenure here because of that.
I think a large part of the problem was that the faculty was almost exclusively white men. And yes. there really wasn't, there weren't other voices that they listened to each other. And, you know, I've been reminded in conversations in other situations like that about the power of people reinforcing each other with their perspectives that have been skewed by a lack of lived experience in anybody else's shoes. And having said that, my professor, Alan Bloom, forever alienated me when he announced to our class that women had made no significant contributions to history, to thought, to philosophy, to anything. The worst Messiah. But my teaching assistant, one of the few women in the government department, and I want to say her name, Leslie Friedman, now Leslie Friedman Goldstein, she helped me through that period of time by giving me one-on-one teaching and helping me learn how to create a logical argument, and I have been forever grateful to her. She went on to have a distinguished career as a professor at the University of Delaware, and she's written on Frederick Douglass and women in constitutional law. So there were, if you had an ally like that, you could find a way to make it through. But no, the faculty was not supportive.
Yes.
My ally back then was Bud Penworthy in the government department. I ended up as a Latin American studies major because I basically took every course he taught. And he was among the, there was a group of, when Bruce was talking about how many more buildings were gonna get taken over, there was a group of faculty that were gonna take over one of the six or seven buildings that was planned. Taken over then, and things shifted. But Bud Kenworthy and Dave Davidson in the history department.
David Davidson.
Let Davidson these days. there were some people in the history department. There was a great teaching in Bailey Hall. With the Southeast Asia Studies people,
You know, that's actually, it hasn't come up before, but I think, George Kahan was his name, K-A-H-A-I-N. But it was, one of the things that was interesting, I think part of the reason that Cornell had is, you know, there was quite a bit of anti-war activism on here, is that we had a bunch of professors who knew more about the real story about what was going on in Southeast Asia than almost anybody else in the country. I mean, they were actually capable of telling us the true story of what the U.S. was doing over there and so on. And I think, so it was a dialectical relationship between the faculty and the students, and the good faculty, of which there certainly were a handful in many of these departments, you know, helped, as I sort of said, many of us form the kind of politics that ultimately led us to become lifelong activists.
Yes.
In view of how students ended up having an effect on their professors, I think it went both ways, because certainly I am aware of many professors, particularly because I know from the history department, that many professors had started out being very against the what was going on. And it was students who had this was with Cahan, and I'm thinking about Walter Bieber, Richard Pollenberg, a number of people who were not in favor, who admittedly turned themselves around, who said mea culpa, I was wrong, and came around, who said that I have changed by my relationship with, when they heard where the students were coming from. So just, my point is, it was really an amazing time. It was a two-way street.
Question here. Are there other questions? We'll take you and then we'll go from there.
Larry Riverby, I was here in the 60s, and I'm now sort of an isolated person living outside of Trumansburg, being a quiet country lawyer. And I want to ask all of the people here, it seems to me that there is possibly a difference between now and then, in a sense, aside from the fact that I am now much older. In the sense that when we came here, it was mentioned this morning at the class that we did, that we were fighting against the Victorian era when we came here, because we came with those values entrenched in
the institution and in the society around us. In 1961, the ethnic and racial divide was entrenched. And coming from reading about or following some of the current stuff, it seems to me that today, for example, the gay divide, the gay issue, if you will, appears ridiculous to perhaps everybody under 25 or to all of us. And perhaps that kind of thing has also gone into other aspects of it, so that the ridiculousness of racism is much more clear. I'm asking this as a question. I'm not denying the institutionalism, okay, and the rest of it, but the ridiculousness is much more clear. Now we have, as of last week, another example of stupidity in the government, okay? We're going to have stupidity entrenched, okay? But they are stupid. And it is clear that they will be stupid. And I would ask the people who are ready to be activists now and the rest of us whether or not this is true, and it's the possibility that the issues have changed and will affect everybody, but that's sort of another question. Is it possible that in organizing today, you are organizing in a different context, and that you could reach past all of those issues because you don't have the same institutional framework or the same ideological framework to be faced? That's the question I would ask.
I just think one needs to ask oneself the question of how much of this last election, which is what we have evidence of recently, has to do with coded aspects of racism that still remain alive and well. There's no way I could look at what happened in this last election and not think that racism is still an absolutely key element of this society. Given how inept the Democrats are anyway, I still think that there is a level of racism that was reflected in this most recent election that scares me. So I think, yes, things have changed in maybe some of the other social issues, such as gay rights, but I would say on the issue of race, one step forward, two steps back, and we still have a really long way to go. That would be my own sense of it. And that race is not one of those issues on which the landscape has been transformed yet.
You got some more questions?
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that. One of the things you said was, seemed to be saying that the fact that the institutions haven't changed isn't as important. I don't know if that was your intention. But the fact that racism is ingrained in the institutions, that's one of the things that really sustains it. Mm-hmm. People come and go, people die. Institutions are here for longer periods of time. And the institutions themselves, racism remains ingrained in the institutions, and therein lies, I believe, the real root of the problem.
I mentioned when I spoke before about starting out fighting about getting people to vote and how hard it is, and we're fighting the same fight today. When I first drove up to Cornell as a freshman in 1965, this is so long ago that Interstate 81 didn't exist yet, we had to drive on Route 96 up from Binghamton. And as I came up, first time I'd ever been up here, on the side of a barn wall, I saw a famous poster, photograph, large, put out by the John Birch Society, someone referred to it earlier class, but called Martin Luther King at a Communist Training School. Which is Dr. King studied at the Highlander Folk Center. It was financed by the John Birch Society. And I think now that we have the Koch brothers, whose father was one of the founders of the John Birch Society, and they were both members of the John Birch Society before it ended, and I don't think their views have changed that much.
As you can imagine, John Birch Society was a ultra-right wing organization of the 1950s, 60s, and beyond. The Highlander Folk School was a place of nonviolent social action and learning and training, which Dr. King, Rosa Parks, and others, Septima Clark, who was a major figure in the civil rights movement, an unsung hero, were all involved in some way or the other, but it was a major training ground for activists during the Black freedom struggle in the 1960s. We are gonna come to a sort of a hard stop here as we are near 6 o'clock, But I want to thank all of you for your very incisive and frank commentary and questions. Again, thanks to our co-sponsors, and thanks especially to our panelists who delivered so wonderfully here this afternoon.